Vion-sur-Salt, France, July 29, 1854. 11. Vion was not supposed to change. When she was growing up, it was always so painfully still, like summer air before a storm, a village carved in stone. And yet, what was it Luke said? Even rocks wear away to nothing. Vion has not worn away. Instead, it has shifted, grown, new roots thrown out, and others cut. The woods have been forced back, trees on the forest edge all felled to feed hearth fires and make way for fields and crops. There are more walls now than there were before, more buildings, more roads. As Addie makes her way through town, hair tucked beneath a well-trimmed bonnet, she marks a name, a face, a ghost of a ghost of a family she once knew. But the Vion of her youth has finally faded, and she wonders if this is what memory feels like for others, this slow erasure of details. For the first time, she does not recognize every path. For the first time, she is not sure she knows her way. She takes a turn, expecting to find one house, but instead finds two, divided by a low stone wall. She goes left, but instead of an open field, she finds a stable, surrounded by a fence. At last, she recognizes the road home, holds her breath as she makes her way down the path, feels something inside her loosen at the sight of the old yew tree, still bent and knotted at the edge of the property. But beyond the tree, the place is changed. New clothes laid over old bones. Her father's workshop has been cleared away, the footprint of the shed marked only by a shadow on the ground, the weedy grass long filled in, a slightly different shade. And though Addie braced herself for the stale stillness of abandoned places, she is met instead by motion, voices, laughter. Someone else has moved into her family home, one of the new arrivals in the growing town, a family with a mother who smiles more, and a father who doesn't, and a pair of boys running in the yard, their hair the color of straw. The older one chases a dog who is absconded with a sock, and the younger one climbs the old yew tree, his bare feet finding the same knots and crooks as hers, back when she was a girl, the drawing pad tucked under her arm. She must have been his age, or was she older? She closes her eyes, tries to catch hold of the image, but it slips and slides between her fingers. Those early memories, not trapped within the prism, those years before, lost to that other life. Her eyes are only closed a moment, but when she opens them, the tree is empty. The boy is gone.
"Hello,"
says a voice somewhere behind her. It is the younger one, his face open and upturned.
"Hello,"
she says.
"Are you lost?"
She hesitates, torn between yes and no, unsure which is closer to the truth.
"I am a ghost," she says.
The boy's eyes widen in surprise, delight, and he asks her to prove it. She tells him to close his eyes, and when he does, she slips away. In the cemetery, the tree Addie transplanted has taken root. It looms over Estelle's grave, bathing her bones in a pool of shade. Addie runs her hand over the bark, marvels at how the sapling has grown into a wide-trunked tree, its roots and branches escaping to every side. 100 years since it was planted, a span of time once too long to fathom, and now too hard to measure. So far, she has counted time in seconds, and in seasons, in cold snaps and in thaws, in uprisings and in aftermaths. She has seen buildings fall and rise, cities burn and be remade, the past and present blurred together into a fluid, ephemeral thing. But this is tangible. The years marked in wood and bark, root and soil. Addie sits back against the woman's grave and rests her own aged bones in the dappled shade and recounts the time since her last visit. She tells Estelle stories of England and Italy and Spain, of Matteo and the gallery, of Luke and her art, and all the ways the world has changed. And even though there is no answer, save the rustle of leaves, she knows what the old woman would say. Everything changes, foolish girl. It is the nature of the world. Nothing stays the same. Except for me, she thinks. But Estelle answers, dry as kindling. Not even you. She has missed the old woman's counsel, even in her head. The voice has gone brittle, worn away in the intervening years, smudged like all those mortal memories. But here, at last, it returns to her. The sun has crossed the sky by the time she rises and walks to the edge of the village, to the edge of the woods, to the place the old woman once called home. But time has claimed this place as well. The garden, once overgrown, has been swallowed up by the encroaching woods, and the wild has won its war against the hut, dragged it down, saplings jutting up among the bones. The wood has rotted, the stones have slipped, the roof is gone, and weed and vine are now in the slow process of dismantling the rest. The next time she comes, there will be no trace, the remains swallowed by the advancing woods. But for now, there is still the skeleton, being slowly buried by the moss. Addie is halfway to the decaying hut when she realizes it is not entirely deserted. A shiver of motion in the ruined mound, and she squints, expecting to find a rabbit or perhaps a young deer. Instead, she finds a boy. He is playing amid the ruins, climbing the remains of the old stone walls, swatting at weeds with a switch pulled from the woods. She knows him. It is the older son, the boy she first saw chasing a dog through her yard. He is maybe 9 or 10, old enough for his eyes to narrow in suspicion when he sees her. He holds out his switch as if it were a sword.
"Who are you?"
he demands. And this time, she is not content to be a ghost. "I am a witch." She doesn't know why she says it, perhaps simply to humor herself, perhaps because when truth is not an option, fiction takes on a mind of its own, or perhaps because it is what Estelle would say if she were here. A shadow crosses the boy's face.
"No such thing as witches," he says.
But his voice is unsteady as he says it, and when she steps forward, shoes cracking over sun-dried branches, he begins to back away.
"Those are my bones you're playing on," she warns. "I suggest you get down before you fall."
The boy stumbles in surprise, nearly slips on a patch of moss. "Unless you'd rather stay," she muses.
"I'm sure there's room for yours as well."
The boy makes it back to the ground and takes off running. Addie watches him go, Estelle's crow-like laughter cawing in her ears. She doesn't feel bad for scaring the child. She does not expect him to remember. And yet, tomorrow, he will come again, and she will stand hidden at the edge of the woods and watch him begin to climb the ruins, only to hesitate, a nervous shadow in his eyes. She will watch him back away, and wonder if he is thinking of witches and half-buried bones, if the idea has grown like a weed in his head. But today, Addie is alone, and her mind is only on Estelle. She runs her hands along a half-fallen wall and thinks of staying, of becoming the witch by the woods, the figment of someone else's dream. She imagines rebuilding the old woman's house, even kneels to stack a few small stones. But by the fourth, the pile crumbles, the rocks landing in the weedy grass exactly as they were before she lifted them. The ink unwrites, the wound uncuts, the house unbuilds. Addie sighs as a handful of birds take flight from the nearby woods, croaking laughter. She turns toward the trees. There is still light left, an hour maybe until night, and yet, staring into the forest,
She can feel the darkness staring back. She wades between the half-buried stones and steps into the shade beneath the trees. A shiver slides through her. It is like stepping through a veil. She weaves between the trees. Once she would have been afraid of getting lost. Now the steps are carved into her memory. She could not lose her way even if she tried. The air is cooler here, the night closer beneath the canopy. It is easy to see now how she lost track of time that day, how the line between dusk and dark became so blurred. And she wonders, would she have called out had she known the hour? Would she have prayed, knowing which God would answer? She does not answer herself. She does not need to. She doesn't know how long he's been there, at her back, if he followed her sometime in quiet, only knows the moment she hears branches crack behind her.
What a strange pilgrimage you insist on making.
Addie smiles to herself. Is it? She turns to see Luke leaning back against a tree. It is not the first time she's seen him since the night he reaped Beethoven's soul, but she still hasn't forgotten what she saw. Nor has she forgotten that he wanted her to see it, to look at him and know the truth of his power. But it was a foolish thing to do, like tipping a hand of cards when the highest bets are on the table. I see you, she thinks as he straightens from the tree. I have seen your truest form. You cannot scare me now. He steps into a shallow pool of light.
What drives you back here?
He asks. Addie shrugs.
Call it nostalgia.
He lifts his chin.
I call it weakness. To only walk in circles when you could make new roads.
Addie frowns. How am I supposed to make a road when I cannot even raise a pile of stones? Set me free and see then how well I fare. He sighs and dissolves into the dark. When he speaks again, he is behind her, his voice a breeze through her hair.
Adeline, Adeline,
he chides. And she knows that if she turns again, he will not be there. And so she holds her ground, keeps her eyes on the forest, does not flinch when his hands slide over her skin, when his arm snakes around her shoulders. Up close, he smells of oak and leaf and rain-soaked field.
Aren't you tired?
He whispers, and she flinches at the words. She braced for his attack, his verbal barbs, but she was not braced for that question, not braced for the almost gentle way he asks. It has been 140 years, a century and a half living as an echo, as a ghost. Of course she is tired.
Wouldn't you like to rest, my dear?
The words drag like gossamer against her skin.
I could bury you here, beside Estelle. Plant a tree, make it grow over your bones.
Addie closes her eyes. Yes, she is tired. She may not feel the years weakening her bones, her body going brittle with age, but the weariness is a physical thing, like rot inside her soul. There are days when she mourns the prospect of another year, another decade, another century. There are nights when she cannot sleep, moments when she lies awake and dreams of dying. But then she wakes and sees the pink and orange dawn against the clouds, or hears the lament of a lone fiddle, the music and the melody, and remembers there is such beauty in the world, and she does not want to miss it, any of it. Addie turns in the circle of Luke's arms and looks up into his face. She doesn't know if it's the creeping night or the nature of the woods themselves, but he looks different. These last few years, she has seen him bound in velvet and lace, done up in the latest fashion, and she has seen him as the void, unbridled and violent. But here, he is neither. Here, he is the darkness she met that night, feral magic, in a lover's form. His edges blur into shadow, his skin the color of moonlight, his eyes the exact shade of the moss behind him. He is wild. But so is she. "Tired?" she says, summoning a smile. "I am just waking up." She braces for his displeasure, the feral shadow, the flash of teeth. But there is no trace of yellow in his eyes. In fact, they are a new and lurid shade of green. It will take years for her to learn the meaning of that color, to understand it as amusement. Tonight, there is only that brief glimpse, and then the brush of his lips against her cheek.
"Even rocks," he murmurs.
And then he's gone.
New York City, June 13th, 2014. 12. A boy and a girl walk arm in arm. They're heading to the knitting factory, and like most things in Williamsburg, it isn't what it sounds like, not a craft store or a place for yarn, but a concert venue on the northern edge of Brooklyn. It is Henry's birthday. Earlier, when he asked her when her birthday was, and when she told him it was back in March, a shadow crossed his face.
"I'm sorry I missed it."
"That's the great thing about birthdays," she said, leaning against him. "They happen every year."
She'd laughed a little then, and so had he, but there was something hollow in his voice, a sadness she mistook for mere distraction. Henry's friends have already staked out a table near the stage, small boxes stacked on the table between them. "Henry!" shouts Robbie, a pair of bottles already empty in front of him. B ruffles his hair.
"Our literal sweet summer child."
Their attention slides past him and lands on her.
"Hi, guys," he says. "This is Addie."
"Finally," says B. "We've been dying to meet you."
Of course, they already have. They've been asking for weeks to meet the new girl in Henry's life. They keep accusing him of hiding her, but Addie has met them over beers at the Merchant, been for movie nights at B's, crossed paths with them at galleries and parks. And every time, B talks of déjà vu, and then again of artistic movements, and every time Robbie sulks, despite Addie's best efforts to placate him. It seems to bother Henry more than it does her. He must think she has made peace with it, but the truth is, there is none to be found. The endless cycle of, "Hello, who is this? Nice to meet you, hello," wears at her like water against stone. The damage slow but inevitable. She has simply learned to live with it.
"You know," says B, studying her, "you look so familiar."
Robbie rises from the table to get a round of drinks, and Addie's chest tightens at the thought of him resetting, of having to start it all again. But Henry steps in, touches Robbie's arm.
"I've got it," he says.
"Birthday doesn't pay," protests B,
but Henry waves her off and wades away through the growing crowd. And Addie is left alone with his friends.
"It's really great to meet you both," she says. "Henry talks about you all the time."
Robbie's eyes narrow in suspicion. She can feel the wall rising up between them, again, but she's no stranger to Robbie's moods, not anymore, and so she presses on.
"You're an actor, right? I'd love to come to one of your performances. Henry says you're amazing."
He picks at the label on his beer.
"Yeah, sure,"
he mumbles, but she catches the edge of a smile when he says it. And then B cuts in.
"Henry seems happy, really happy."
"I am,"
says Henry, setting down a round of beers.
"To 29,
says B, raising her glass. They proceed to debate the merits of the age and agree it is a fairly useless year as far as birthdays go, falling just shy of the monumental 30. B collars Henry.
But next year, you'll officially be an adult.
I'm pretty sure that was 18, he says.
Don't be ridiculous. 18 is old enough to vote, 21 is old enough to drink, but 30 is old enough to make decisions.
Closer to a midlife crisis than a quarter-life one, teases Robbie. The microphone flares, whining slightly as a man takes the stage and announces a special opening act.
He's a rising star. I'm sure you've heard his name, but if you haven't, you will soon. Give it up for Toby Marsh!
Addie's heart lurches. The crowd whoops and cheers, and Robbie whistles, and Toby steps onto the stage, that same beautiful, blushing boy. But as he waves to the crowd, his chin lifts, his smile is steady, proud. The difference between the first questing lines of a sketch and the finished drawing. He sits down at the piano and begins to play, and the first notes hit her like longing, and then he begins to sing. I'm in love with a girl I've never met. Time slips, and she is in his living room, perched on the piano bench, tea steaming on the windowsill as her absent fingers pick out the notes. But I see her every night, it seems. She is in his bed, his broad hands playing out the melody on skin. Her face flares hot at the memory as he sings. And I'm so afraid, afraid that I'll forget her, even though I've only met her in my dreams. She never gave him the words, but he found them anyway. His voice is clearer, stronger, his tone more confident. He just needed the right song, something to make the crowd lean in and listen. Addie squeezes her eyes shut, the past and present tangling together in her head. All those nights at the alleyway, watching him play. All the times he found her at the bar and smiled. All those firsts that were not firsts for her. The palimpsest bleeding up through the paper. Toby looks up from the piano, and there's no way he can see her in a place this big, but she is sure his eyes meet hers, and the room tilts a little, and she doesn't know if it's the beers she drank too fast or the vertigo of memory, but then the song ends, replaced by a warm wave of applause, and she is on her feet, moving toward the door.
Addie, wait, says Henry, but she can't, even though she knows what it means to walk away.
Knows that Robbie and B will forget her, and she will have to start again, and so will Henry. But in that moment, she doesn't care. She cannot breathe. The door swings open, and the night rushes in, and Addie gasps, forcing air into her lungs. And it should feel good to hear her music. It should feel right. After all, she has gone to visit pieces of her art so many times. But they were only pieces, stripped of context, sculpted birds on marble plinths and paintings behind ropes, didactic boxes taped to whitewashed walls and glass boxes that keep the present from the past. It is a different thing when the glass breaks. It is her mother in the doorway, withered to bone. It is Remy in the Paris salon. It is Sam inviting her to stay every time. It is Toby Marsh playing their song. The only way Addie knows how to keep going is to keep going forward. They are Orpheus, she is Eurydice, and every time they turn back, she is ruined.
Addie?
Henry is right behind her.
What's wrong?
I'm sorry,
she says. She wipes the tears away and shakes her head because the story is too long and too short.
I can't go back in there. Not now.
Henry looks over his shoulder, and he must have seen the color drop from her face during the show, because he says,
Do you know him? That Toby Marsh guy?
She hasn't told him that story. They haven't gotten there yet.
I did,
she says, which isn't strictly true because it makes it sound like something in the past, when the past is the one thing Addie's not entitled to. and Henry must hear the lie buried in the words because he frowns. He laces his hands behind his head.
Do you still have feelings for him?
And she wants to be honest, to say that of course she does. She never gets closure, never gets to say goodbye. No periods, no exclamations, just a lifetime of ellipses. Everyone else starts over. They get a blank page, but hers are full of text. People talk about carrying torches for old flames, and it's not a full fire, but Addie's hands are full of candles. How is she supposed to set them down or put them out? She has long run out of air. But it is not love. It is not love. And that is what he's asking.
No, she says. It caught me off guard. I'm sorry.
Henry asks if she wants to go home, and Addie doesn't know if he means both of them or only her, doesn't want to find out, so she shakes her head, and they go back in, and the lights have changed, and the stage is empty, the house music filling the air until the main act, and Bea and Robbie are chatting, heads bent just the way they were when they walked in, and Addie does her best to smile as they reach the table.
There you are, says Robbie.
Where did you run off to? Asks Bea, eyes flicking from Henry to her.
And who's this?
He slides his arm around her waist.
Guys, this is Addie.
Robbie looks her up and down, but Bea only beams.
Finally, she says. We've been dying to meet you.
En route to Berlin, Germany, July 29th, 1872. 13. The glasses rattle faintly on the table as the train rolls through the German countryside. Addie sits in the dining car, sipping her coffee and staring out the window, marveling at the speed with which the world goes past. Humans are capable of such wondrous things, of cruelty and war, but also art and invention. She will think this again and again over the years, when bombs are dropped and buildings felled, when terror consumes whole countries, but also when the first images are impressed on film, when planes rise into the air, when movies go from black and white to color. She is amazed. She will always be amazed. Lost in her thoughts, she doesn't hear the conductor until he is beside her, one hand coming to rest lightly on her shoulder.
Fräulein, he says, your ticket, please.
Addie smiles. Of course. She looks down at the table, pretends to shuffle through her purse.
I'm sorry, she says, rising. I must have left it in my room.
It is not the first time they have done this dance, but it is the first time the porter has decided to follow her, trailing like a shadow as she makes her way toward a car she does not have, for a ticket that she never bought. Addie quickens her pace, hoping to put a door between them, but it is no use. The conductor is with her every step, and so she slows and stops before a door that leads to a room that is certainly not hers, hoping that at least it will be empty. It is not. As she reaches for the handle, it escapes, sliding open onto a dim compartment, an elegant man leaning in the doorway, black curls drawn like ink against his temples. Relief rolls through her.
Herr Wild,
says the conductor, straightening, as if the man in the door were a duke and not the darkness. Luke smiles.
There you are, Adeline.
He says, in a voice as smooth and rich as summer honey. His green eyes slide from her to the conductor.
She has a way of running off, my wife. Now, he says, a sly smile on his lips, what's brought you back to me?
Addie manages a smile of her own, cloyingly sweet.
My love, she says, I forgot my ticket.
He chuckles, drawing a slip of paper from the pocket of his coat. Luke draws Addie close.
What a forgetful thing you are, my dear. She bristles, but holds her tongue, leans instead into the weight of him. The conductor surveys the slip and wishes them a pleasant night, and the moment he is gone, she pulls away from Luke.
My Adeline.
He clicks his tongue.
That is no way to treat a husband.
I am not yours, she says, and I did not need your help.
Of course not,
he answers dryly.
Come, let's not quarrel in the hall.
Luke draws her into the compartment, or at least that is what she thinks he is doing, but instead of stepping into the familiar confines of the cabin, she finds only the darkness, vast and deep. Her heart catches on the missed step, the sudden drop, as the train falls away, the world falls away, and they are back in the nothing, the hollow space between. And she knows she will never fully know it, never be able to wrap her mind around the nature of the dark. Because, she realizes now, what it is, this place. It is him. It is the truth of him, the vast and savage night, the darkness full of promise and violence, fear and freedom. And when the night shudders back into shape around them, they are no longer on the German train, but on a street, in the center of a city she does not yet know is Munich. And she should be mad at the abduction, the sudden change in the direction of her night, but she cannot stifle the curiosity blossoming in the wake of her confusion, the sudden flush of something new, the thrill of adventure. Her heart quickens, but she resolves not to let him see her marvel. She suspects he does anyway. There is a pleased glint in those eyes, a thread of darker green. They are standing on the steps of a pillared opera house, her traveling clothes gone, replaced by a far finer dress, and Addie wonders if the gown is real, as far as anything is real, or simply the conjurings of smoke and shadow. Luke stands beside her, a gray scarf around his collar, green eyes dancing beneath the brim of a silk top hat. The evening bustles with movement, men and women climbing the steps arm in arm to see the show. She learns that it is Wagner. It is Tristan und Isolde, though these things mean nothing to her yet. She does not know it is the height of his career. She does not know it has become his masterpiece, but she can taste the promise like sugar in the air as they pass through a lobby of marble columns and painted arches and into a concert hall of velvet and gold. Luke rests a hand on the small of her back, guiding her forward to the front of a balcony, a low box with a perfect view of the stage. Her heart quickens with excitement before she remembers Florence. "Do not mistake this for kindness," he said. "I simply want to be the one who breaks you." But there is no mischief in his eyes as they take their seats, no cruel twist to his smile, only the languid pleasure of a cat in the sun. Two glasses arrive, brimming with champagne, and he holds one out to her.
"Happy anniversary,"
he says, as the lights dim and the curtain rises. It begins with music. The rising tension of a symphony, notes like waves, rolling through the hall, crashing against the walls, the inversion of a storm against a ship. And then, the arrival of Tristan, of Isolde, their voices larger than the stage. She has heard musicals, of course, heard symphonies and plays, voices so pure they bring her to tears. But she has never heard anything like this. The way they sing, the scope and scale of their emotions, the desperate passion in their movements, the raw power of their joy and pain. She wants to bottle this feeling, to carry it with her through the dark. It will be years before she hears a record of this symphony and turns the volume up until it hurts, surrounds herself with sound, though it will never be the same as this. Once, Addie tears her gaze from the players on the stage, only to see that Luke is watching her instead of them. And there it is again, that peculiar shade of green. Not coy or chiding, not cruel, but pleased. She will realize later that this is the first night he does not ask for her surrender. The first time he makes no mention of her soul. But right now, she is thinking only of the music, the symphony, the story. She is drawn back to the stage by the anguish in a note, by the tangle of limbs in an embrace, by the look of lovers on the stage. She leans forward, breathes the opera in until it aches inside her chest. The curtain falls on the first act, and Addie is on her feet, ringing with applause. Luke laughs, soft as silk, as she sinks back into her seat.
You are enjoying it.
And she doesn't lie, even despite him. It is wonderful. A smile plays across his face.
Can you guess which ones are mine?
At first, she does not understand. And then, of course, she does. Her spirits sink.
Are you here to claim them?
She asks, relieved when Luke shakes his head.
No, he says. Not tonight, but soon.
Addie shakes her head.
I don't understand. Why end their lives as they're reaching their peak?
He looks at her.
They made their deal. They knew the cost.
Why would anyone trade a lifetime of talent for a few years of glory?
Luke's smile darkens.
Because time is cruel to all, and crueler still to artists. Because vision weakens, and voices wither, and talent fades.
He leans close, twists a lock of her hair around one finger.
Because happiness is brief, and history is lasting, and in the end,
he says,
everyone wants to be remembered.
The words are a knife, cutting swift and deep. Addie knocks his hand away and turns her attention back to the stage as the opera resumes. It is a long play, and yet it is over too soon. Hours gone in moments. Addie wishes she could stay, tucked in this seat, and start the opera again, fold herself between the lovers and their tragedy, lose herself in the beauty of their voices. And yet, she cannot help but wonder, if all the things that Addie has loved, she loved because of them or him? Luke stands, offering his arm. She does not take it. They walk side by side through the Munich night, and Addie still feels buoyant in the wake of the opera, the voices ringing through her like a bell. But Luke's question echoes too. Which of them are mine? She looks at him, the elegant shape beside her in the dark.
What is the strangest deal you've ever done?
Luke tips his head back and considers.
Joan of Arc, he says. A soul for a blessed sword, so that she could not be struck down.
Addie frowns.
But she was.
Ah, but not in battle.
Luke's smile goes sly.
Semantics may seem small, Adeline, but the power of a deal is in its wording. She asked for the protection of a god while it was in her hands. She did not ask for the ability to keep hold of it.
Addie shakes her head, bemused.
I refuse to believe that Joan of Arc made a deal with the dark.
The smile splits, showing teeth.
Well, perhaps I let her believe I was a little more angelic. But deep down, I think she knew. Greatness requires sacrifice. Who you sacrifice to matters less than what you sacrifice for, and in the end, she became what she wanted to be.
A martyr?
A legend.
Addie shakes her head.
But the artists, think of all they could have done. Don't you mourn their loss?
Luke's face darkens, and she remembers his mood the night he met her in the National, remembers his first words in Beethoven's room. What a waste.
Of course I do, he says. But all great art comes with a cost.
He looks away.
You should know that. After all, we are both patrons in our way.
I am nothing like you, she says, but there is not much venom in the words. I am a muse, and you are a thief. He shrugs.
Give and take, he says,
and nothing more. But when it's late, and he is gone, and she is left to wander, the opera plays on, perfectly preserved inside the prism of her memory, and Addie wonders, softly, silently, if their souls were a fair price for such fine art.
New York City, July 4th, 2014. 14. Lights explode over the city. They've gathered on the roof of Robbie's building, along with 20 other people, to watch the fireworks go off, paint the Manhattan skyline pink and green and gold. Addie and Henry stand together, of course, but it's too hot to touch. His glasses keep fogging, and he seems less interested in drinking his beer than holding the can against his neck. A breeze trickles through the air, carrying as much relief as a dryer vent, and everyone on the roof makes exaggerated noises, letting out oohs and ahs that might be for the fireworks, or simply the limp gust of air. A kiddie pool sits in the center of the roof, surrounded by lawn chairs, a huddle of people sloshing their feet in the tepid water. The fireworks finish, and Addie looks around for Henry, but he's wandered off. He's been in a strange mood all day, but she assumes it's the heat, sitting like a weight on everything. The bookstore was closed, and they spent most of the day stretched together on the sofa in front of a box fan, book pawing at an ice cube as they watch TV, the heat enough to temper even Henry's manic energy. She was too tired to tell him stories. He was too tired to write them down. The rooftop doors burst open, and Robbie appears, looking as if he's raided an ice cream truck, his arms full of melting ice pops. People whoop and cheer, and he makes his rounds of the roof, doling out once frozen treats. 12th time's the charm, she thinks, as he hands her a fruit bar, but even though he doesn't remember her, Henry's obviously said enough. Or perhaps Robbie simply recognizes everyone else and makes the deduction. One of these things is not like the others. Addie doesn't lose a second. She breaks into a sudden grin.
Oh my God, you must be Robbie!
She throws her arms around his neck.
Henry's told me all about you.
Robbie pulls free.
Did he?
You're the actor. He said you're amazing, that it's only a matter of time before you're on Broadway.
Robbie blushes a little, looks away.
I'd love to come to one of your shows. What are you performing in right now?
Robbie hesitates, but she can feel him faltering, torn between shunning her and sharing his news.
We're doing a spin on Faust, he says. You know, man makes a deal with the devil.
Addie bites into the ice pop, sending a wave of shock through her teeth. It is enough to mask the grimace as Robbie goes on.
But it's going to be set against a stage that's more labyrinth. Think Mephistopheles, but by way of the Goblin King.
He gestures at himself when he says it.
It's a really cool spin. The costumes are amazing. Anyway, it doesn't open until September.
It sounds wonderful, she says. I can't wait to see.
At that, Robbie almost smiles.
I think it will be pretty cool.
To Faust, she says, lifting her ice pop.
And the devil, answers Robbie.
Her hands have gone sticky, and she dunks them in the kiddie pool and goes in search of Henry. She finally finds him alone in a corner of the roof, a stretch where the lights don't reach. He's staring out, not up, but down over the edge.
I think I finally cracked Robbie,
she says, wiping her hands on her shorts.
Hmm?
he says, not really listening. A bead of sweat runs down his cheek, and he closes his eyes into the faint summer breeze and sways a little on his feet. Addie pulls him away from the edge.
What's wrong?
His eyes are dark, and for a moment he looks haunted, lost.
Nothing, he says softly. Just thinking.
Addie has lived long enough to recognize a lie. Lying is its own language, like the language of seasons or gestures or the shade of Luke's eyes. So she knows that Henry is lying to her now. Or at least he's not telling her the truth. And maybe it is just one of his storms, she thinks. Maybe it is the summer heat. It is not, of course, and later she will know the truth, and she will wish she'd asked, wish she'd pressed, wish she'd known. Later. But tonight, he pulls her close. Tonight, he kisses her, deeply, hungrily, as if he can make her forget what she saw. And Addie lets him try. That night, when they get home, it is too hot to think, to sleep, so they fill the bathtub with cold water, turn off the lights, and climb inside, shivering at the sudden, merciful relief. They lie there in the dark, bare legs intertwined beneath the water. Henry's fingers play a melody across her knee. When we first met, he muses, why didn't you tell me your real name? Addie looks up at the darkened ceiling tiles and sees Isabel as she was that last day, sitting at the table, her eyes gone empty. She sees Remy in the cafe, staring dreamily past her words, unable to hear them. Because I didn't think I could, she says, running her fingers through the water. When I try to tell people the truth, their faces just go blank. When I try to say my name, it always gets stuck in my throat. She smiles. Except with you. But why? He asks. If you're going to be forgotten, what does it matter if you tell the truth? Addie closes her eyes. It's a good question, one she's asked herself 100 times. I think he wanted to erase me, to make sure I felt unseen, unheard, unreal. You don't really realize the power of a name until it's gone. Before you, he was the only one who could say it. The voice curls like smoke inside her head. Oh, Adeline, Adeline, Adeline. My Adeline. What an asshole, says Henry, and she chuckles, remembering the nights she screamed up at the sky, called the darkness so much worse. And then he asks, when's the last time you saw him? And Addie falters. For an instant, she is in a bed, black silk sheets twisted around her limbs, the New Orleans heat oppressive even in the dark. But Luke is a cool weight wrapped around her limbs, his teeth skating along her shoulder as he whispers the word against her skin, surrender. Addie swallows, pushes the memory down like bile in her throat. Almost 30 years ago, she says, as if she doesn't count the days, as if the anniversary isn't rushing up to meet them. She glances sideways at the clothes piled on the bathroom floor, the indent of the wooden ring in the pocket of her shorts. We had a falling out, she says, and it is the barest version of the truth. Henry looks at her, clearly curious, but he doesn't ask what happened, and for that she is grateful. There is an order to the story. She will tell him when she gets there. For now, Addie reaches up and turns the shower on, and it falls down on them like rain, soothing and steady. And this is the perfect kind of silence, easy and empty. They sit across from each other beneath the icy stream, and Addie closes her eyes and tips her head back against the tub and listens to the makeshift storm. The Cotswolds. England, December 31st, 1899.
15. It is snowing. Not a patina of frost or a few wayward flakes, but a dousing of white. Addie sits curled in the window of the little cottage, a fire at her back and a book open on her knee as she watches the sky fall. She has ushered in the change of years so many ways. Perched on London rooftops holding bottles of champagne and torch in hand through the cobbled roads of Edinburgh, she has danced in the halls of Paris and watched the sky go white with fireworks in Amsterdam. She has kissed strangers and sung of friends she'll never meet, gone out with bangs and with whispers. But tonight, she is content to sit and watch the world go white beyond the window, every line and curve erased by snow. The cottage is not hers, of course, not in the strictest sense. She found it more or less intact, a place abandoned or simply forgotten. The furniture was threadbare, the cupboards almost empty, but she has had a season to make it hers, to gather wood from the copse of trees across the field, to tend the wild garden, and steal what she could not grow. It is simply a place to rest her bones. Outside, the storm has stopped. The snow lies quiet on the ground, as smooth and clean as unmarked paper. Perhaps that is what drives her to her feet. She pulls the cloak tight around her shoulders and surges out, boots sinking instantly into the snow. It is light, whipped into a sugar film, the taste of winter on her tongue. Once, when she was 5 or 6, it snowed back in Villon, a rare sight, a film of white several inches deep that coated everything. In hours, it was ruined by horses and carts and people trudging to and fro, but Addie found a small expanse of untouched white. She rushed out into it, leaving a trail of shoes. She ran bare hands over the frozen sheets, left fingers in her wake. She ruined every inch of the canvas. And when she was done, she looked around at the field, now covered in tracks, and mourned that it was over. The next day, the frost broke and the ice melted, and it was the last time she played in snow. Until now. Now, her steps crunch the perfect snow and it rises in her wake. Now, she runs her fingers through the gentle hills and they smooth behind her touch. Now, she plays in the field and does not leave a mark. The world remains unblemished, and for once, she is grateful. She spins and twirls and dances partnerless across the snow, laughing at the strange and simple magic of the moment, before stepping wrong, a patch deeper than she thought. She loses her balance and crashes down into the pile of white, gasping at the sudden cold along her collar, the snow that creeps inside her hood. She looks up. It has begun to snow again, lightly now, flakes falling like stars. The world goes muffled, a cotton kind of quiet, and if it were not for the icy damp leaching through her clothes, she thinks she could stay here forever. She decides she will at least stay here for now. She sinks into the snow, lets it swallow the edges of her sight until there is nothing but a frame around the open sky, the night cold and clear and full of stars. And she is 10 again, stretched in the tall grass behind her father's workshop, dreaming she is anywhere but home. How strange the winding way a dream comes true. But now, gazing up into the endless dark, she does not think of freedom, but of him. And then, he's there, standing over her, haloed by the dark, and she thinks perhaps she is going mad again. It would not be the first time.
200 years, Luke says, kneeling beside her, and still behaving like a child.
What are you doing here?
I could ask the same of you.
He holds out his hand, and she takes it, lets him draw her up out of the cold, and together they walk back to the little house, leaving only his steps in the snow. Inside, the fire has gone out, and she groans a little to herself, reaching for the lantern, hoping it will be enough to coax the fire back to life. But Luke only looks at the smoking ruins and flicks his fingers in an absent way, and the flames surge up inside the hearth, a bloom of heat casting shadows over everything. How easily he moves through the world, she thinks. How hard he's made it for her. Luke considers the little cottage, the borrowed life.
My Adeline, he says, still longing to grow up and become Estelle.
I am not yours, she says, though by now the words have lost their venom.
All the world, and you pass your time playing the part of a witch in the wild, a crone praying to old gods.
I did not pray to you, and yet you're here. She takes him in, dressed in a wool coat and cashmere scarf, the collar high against his cheeks, and realizes this is the first time she has seen Luke in winter. It suits him, as well as summer did. The fair skin of his cheeks gone marble white, the black curls the color of the moonless sky, those green eyes, as cold and bright as stars. And the way he looks, standing before the fire, she wishes she could draw him. Even after all this time, her fingers itch for charcoal. He runs a hand over the mantle.
I saw an elephant in Paris.
Her words to him, so many years before. It is such a strange answer now, filled with unspoken things. I saw an elephant and thought of you. I was in Paris and you were not. And you thought of me, she says. It is a question. He does not answer. Instead, he looks around and says,
This is a pitiful way to usher out a year. We can do better. Come with me.
And she is curious. She is always curious. But tonight, she shakes her head.
No.
That proud chin lifts. Those dark brows draw together.
Why not?
Addie shrugs.
Because I'm happy here, and I do not trust you to bring me back.
His smile flickers like firelight, and she expects that to be the end of that, to turn and find him gone, stolen back into the dark. But he's still there, this shadow in her borrowed home. He lowers himself into the second chair. He conjures cups of wine from nothing, and they sit before the fire like friends, or at least like foes at rest, and he tells her of Paris at the close of a decade, the turn of a century, of the writers blooming like flowers, of the art and the music and the beauty. He has always known how to tempt her. He says it is a golden age, a time of light.
You would enjoy it,
he says.
I'm sure I would.
She will go, in the spring, and see the World's Fair, witness the Eiffel Tower, the iron sculpture climbing toward the sky. She will walk through buildings made of glass, ephemeral installations, and everyone will talk of the old century and the new one, as if there is a line in the sand between present and past, as if it does not all exist together. History is a thing designed in retrospect. For now, she listens to him talk, and it is enough. She does not remember drifting off, but when she wakes, it is early in the morning, and the cottage is empty, the fire little more than embers. A blanket has been cast over her shoulders, and beyond the window, the world is white again. And Addie will wonder if he was ever there. Part 6. Do not pretend that this is love. Title: Dream Girl. Artist: Toby Marsh. Date: 2014. Medium: sheet music. Location: on loan from the Pershing family. Description: This piece of original sheet music, signed by singer-songwriter Toby Marsh, captures the beginnings of the song Dream Girl and was auctioned off as part of the Music Notes annual gala to fund public school arts programs in New York City.
While some of the lyrics differ from the final song, the most famous lines, "I'm so afraid, afraid that I'll forget her, even though I've only met her in my dreams," are clearly legible in the center of the page. Background. This is largely considered to be the song that launched Marsh's career. The musician has only added to the mythology surrounding the subject by claiming the song came to him over the course of several dreams. "I would wake up with bars of music in my head," he said in a 2016 interview with Paper Magazine. "I'd find lyrics scribbled on notepads and receipts, but I had no memory of writing them. It was like sleepwalking, sleep making. The whole thing was a dream." Marsh denies being under the influence of any drugs at the time. Estimated value, $15,000.